In Canada, you see his work everywhere. An original by Norvell Morrison. Priceless. But
it became clear that there were more and more fakes.
A story that impacts Indigenous artists around the world.
How has nobody ever looked into this?
Forgeries, fakes, and fortunes to be made. An art fraud of epic proportions.
I either have to let this go or try to find out what the truth is.
Binge the full series now on the ABC Listen app or weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When Jamaica Moana came into the world, the music of Bob Marley was playing. Jamaica's dad was a huge fan of the reggae star, and he and Jamaica's mum had decided that whatever gender their new baby was, they would call them Jamaica in honour of Bob Marley's homeland. The couple already had five sons together and were part of a big extended Maori and Samoan clan living between New Zealand and Australia. Jamaica's dad was an interstate truck driver and his motto was keeping it real. And this became something of a guiding star for Jamaica as she grew into a teenager and became a pioneer in her community. Jamaica Moana's debut album is out now. And it's named for her parents, Bud and Denny. Hi, Jamaica.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
It is our pleasure. Let's start by hearing about your family's ancestral home. Where is it?
Yes, so my family, my Maori heritage, which is on both sides, within my father and my mother, is in two places. So my father's side is from down the line, which is from Huntly, from the Waikato, and my mother's side is from Hokianga, which is up the top in Aotearoa. So two very different spaces, but hold a very, very valuable piece of calmness and serenity in my mind.
Tell me about Hokianga. What does it look like?
I just had the blessing to be in Hokianga recently, so I can describe it very, very easy. At the back of my grandfather's small home, at the front step, it's walking onto the stairs, and the stairs just end onto the end of the sand, which is meters away from the ocean. So my grandfather's front yard is this beautiful Hokianga harbour, which is this endless meeting point of two ends of it, the islands coming and meeting point in together, and you are sitting in the center of this harbor. Absolutely incredible. It feels like there's 90 miles of sand going to the left and to the right, and even on a rainy day in this place it seems sunny. Something about this place really makes you feel shining, positive, all of that. That's what Hokianga is physically and mentally and spiritually. You just feel all of those vibes, yeah.
And culturally, for Maori people, why is it such an important place, Hokianga?
Hokianga is so important because it is the first meeting point of Aotearoa being found by our first ancestor, Kupe. And Kupe came and founded Aotearoa through Hokianga Harbour. The first point that he touched was actually where I sit in front of my granddad's home. So it is absolutely important for so many Maori people, because what I've been taught in my family is that no matter who you are, what opportunities you have, you will always return back to Hokianga, because that's where our place and that's where our spirit has started. No matter what you do, as long as you are Maori and from that ancestral lineage, you will return back to Hokianga, because at the end of the day, we are just spirits. I'm navigating through these physical vessels as Maori people, right? Yeah.
What are your earliest memories of being in Hokianga?
My earliest memories of being in Hokianga would be taking a bath from my grandparents in the sink, in the kitchen sink, a very small sink. But it just, I remember it feeling like it was the ocean. Just always feeling like it was so held in that space. I remember many generations above me, many aunties, many uncles, many cousins that were older than me. I just remember Hokianga being our moral compass in our family, no matter what age you are or what job you've got or where you've moved to, that you ensure that you're back there. So that's being so small, getting by, like bathed in that space. I just remember looking around feeling like family was everything, because family was very normal. You know, that's what I could see. So, yeah.
How many kids were already in your family, Jamaica, when you came along?
I have five older brothers. Five straight older brothers, and I was the one that came into the world and just changed things up a little bit.
And you were all living, your family's base was in Auckland at that time. What was life like there for you? What do you remember about that time?
I just remember being a child that was always looked after. Like, I, as the youngest one, I just always remember us, like, no matter what, financial struggles, because to be honest, like, living in South Auckland, you don't really come from huge financial abundance. So what we really lived for is, I remember we didn't have much in terms of financial abundance, but in terms of, like, riches in life, like, that's in terms of, that's exactly what we had. And that's what a moral compass from Bob Marley's music and what his lessons were taught is that, yes, you, when somebody asks, there's an interview that he was asked, and it's like, are you rich? And they're like, does money define riches, or is it experiences? Is it love? Is it family? So growing up in Auckland, that's what we had. We had each other. We had our minds. We had our imagination. We had love. That's what I remember. I didn't have any knowing of bills or anything back then, you know. I've come to later understand that it was hard, you know. It was hard to make things meet and get across to the next week. But I do remember that no one ever went without a home, and no one ever went without food, the thing, and no one ever went without a smile is what I remember. Yeah.
So what was it that brought your family to Australia, to Western Sydney, when you were still a little boy?
I think that initially the opportunity of it all, and coming to over to connect with other family that was over here. There was some extended family here, but it was just to be able to give our whānau the opportunity to maybe have something more than the ceiling of expectation in South Auckland of where we were living. What if we could be in a place where we could have that financial abundance, where we could have careers that we really could take on? I think that's why I must say as well that the trajectory of moving over to Sydney and Australia is not mandatory and defining of success for Maori people. Like, that's not it. But just for me and our family, that's how we navigated. We moved in across the ditch, but we never forgot where we're from. Our grandfather always ingrains that in our mind, is that you can't ever get too big for your little boots, girl. You know, you better remember where you're from. Yeah.
How was it starting school in Sydney for you?
I remember we were very close to a lot of Maori people, so that felt like it was South Auckland again. Like, it, that itself looked like the town that we were growing up in. The thing for me was that I didn't see very many queer people. Definitely did not see many queer Maori people. And as a child growing up as the youngest of five older straight brothers, with no physical example of queerness in family or in my home, that was really reiterated when I went to school, because I realized, oh my gosh, like, I really am unique, you know. My family just knew that I would say different. Like, that was a word. My family just knew that I was different. It wasn't weird, it wasn't thing. It just knew that, oh, this one, you know, this a bit different off the conveyor belt. Yeah.
What was your dad doing for work when the family moved to Sydney?
My dad was a consistent interstate truck driver the entire time. That was his job we grew up with. He would be in town for his breaks, and then he would be away for his big trips, maybe for an overnight trip or a weekend trip. But those were very fond memories of of me just being in that truck. And yeah.
Would Bob Marley be playing as he
every
drove?
Time. Every, and you know, I remember in the truck, because it was this Kenworth truck, that was just this big, big, big truck. And weirdly, people wouldn't expect that I have a fondness of big, big trucks, you know, semi-trailers. These, for me, it finds a comfort to me. The top of, you know, the visor where you have the mirror, I just remember it being like CD, like CDs galore of Bob Marley. Like, I'm sure I've still got these as well, but absolutely not much else was allowed to be played. And if it was played, it better have been in the same era, because that, I think time really just froze when it came to music in our photo, in our home.
Was he a tough kind of imposing guy, your dad? You know, I have an impression of a Maori man driving semi-trailers as sort of a physically, I've got an image in my mind what he might have been like. Did he fit that stereotype?
He was, yes, from the outside, he definitely looked like that. He looked like a very unapproachable man, let me say that. Like, just somebody that wouldn't have the time of day. But within our home, within our walls, the man was different. You know, that defense mechanism didn't really need to be there. It was more of a direct line, a line that took a lot more. I think the more that, as he had more kids, he softened up more and more. And just as me, you know, I was sort of the last puzzle piece to be like, let's soften you up right up.
What did the two of you call one another?
I called him Bud because he looked like a Buddha with bald hair. And he called me Donut. So Bud and Donut.
Why Donut?
Oh, I think we went through a time of just munching together. We used to love, like, we used to go for frappe runs together. And, like, I guess donut runs were a thing for a big period of time there.
So what about your mum's presence at home, Jamaica? Was she a contrast to your dad, or how did she fill the home?
My parents, I will say, is, like, the definition of yin and yang. The definition of yin and yang, very two different people, but as much as they're so different, there's an equal part of their being that are so entwined. And that's what I mean about the yin and yang, is like, you've got this, you know, hearty truck driving Maori man, but then you've got this like hippie enlightened, like healing spirit woman. Like, it's, for me, when it was like, if I wanted to feel strong, I'm going to look to the left. If I'm wanting to feel healed, I'm looking to the right. You know, like, that's what it was in our home. But my parents definitely had, like, they were, as much as they were very different, they still had very likeness to each other as well. Like, mum was definitely not as any less strong than my father, you know. Or my father was like, he was trying to be a healer, you know, but he tried. He didn't have any less intention of trying to do that.
Tell me about the conversation you had with your mum when she took you to see the movie Frozen back when you were in year 9.
Oh, I love that. We ended up going to the cinema on New Year's Eve, and we got like our little choc tops, we got our popcorn and everything, and we sat down, we watched the full movie, and then afterwards I ended up having a New Year's party at my brother's house, and she ended up driving me. It was about a 20-minute drive, and I was like mustered up in the chest, right? I was like, oh my gosh, it's the time. And as soon as we got out of the car, like, I said it to her, I came out to my mum, and I remember there was no, like, pause, no nothing. It was just initial, like, oh, I know, babe. Like, she's like, telling, like, you don't need to, oh, like that. She simply said, I know, babe, and gave me a hug and said, have a good night. But in those simple words, it was very much like, you don't need to ever, like, be nervous about who you are, because we're going to have your back. And if we don't, we're going to learn, you know. And that was like the men in my family, they learned as well. They learned how to love somebody like me, because a Maori family from South Auckland, it's very hard to come by to love or be used to people like me if you don't have a sibling or a cousin or someone that's like that, you know. And I love that I'm able to be that person for the next generation, for my babies, for my nephews. You know, they go to school and they're able to be like, oh, that queer person in my class is just like Auntie Jam. You know, I love that.
After that conversation with your mom and her just immediate spontaneous affirmation and honouring of who you are, what did that mean day to day? I mean, did you start presenting yourself differently knowing that you had her support, and did that allow you to start showing up at school or at home in a different way?
Yes. So when I came out and felt all that love from my mom, my whole being was shining. Like that, in terms of, wasn't even needing to put on clothes, like just to be able to be that accepted. And I have to note as well that mum got us a home as well when my parents split. So at this time when I came out, we were in this home, and this was like a new place where it felt like, oh, Denny is allowing this home to be the place that I really let loose and I let it out, you know? So yeah, I remember just every day I was allowed to be me. I was allowed to wear what I wanted to wear. I swear, I think it was like that weekend, the next day, where I was in a full gown, a full wig, full makeup, a handbag, like heels. And my brothers were in the lounge going, what? Like, they were just like, and I with like my actions really showed them all. It was like, I'm so sorry, but you're going to have to get used to it. You're going to have to jump onto the train and really find it. And they, I will say they did really well with
and
that.
You were like 13, 14, something like that,
Jamaica? I was 15 when 15. I came out. Yeah.
And so what did that look like at school?
Oh, well, that really translated into that, into my entire life. So when I came out at home, because that felt like the biggest beast to tackle was my whānau. Because I had that on lock, I was not caring about anyone. Like, anyone at school, at the bakery, oh, like, I'm definitely wearing what I want because I'm allowed to in my home. So I was not taking the skirt off at all. The skirt was staying, the wig was staying, the girl's uniform was on my body. Like, I was making sure that I was walking through. And I think because a lot of people in my town that I was going to school in, they kind of learned as I was learning myself. And like, as I was learning my own experiences and my look, they were seeing it as well. I went through many phases. I went through like a big purple green mohawk and all like a rock star girl for a little bit. They really seen these moments. But when it came back to me wearing all of these uniforms and all of this stuff, my school, they didn't care by the end. Junior years, yes, I had to teach people. It's a learning lesson, especially out west as well, to teach people about acceptance and love for people like me. But yeah.
How do you look back at that young you, that Jamaica who decided, okay, at 15, I'm going to embrace this and teach, you know, my peers and my teachers and other parents? I mean, are you kind of amazed at her courage or what? How do you feel about her?
Oh, I'm so proud of her. Absolutely. Like, the audacity, the fearlessness, like, I'm so glad she never dropped the ball. And those crazy ideas, like, I'm really, really proud of her. I'm also, I'm glad that I like did all of that experimenting and all of that with my looks back then, because it was quite a variety.
You're not rocking the mohawk anymore, no, Jamaica.
No, we put her to rest. But I give it up to her. I give it up to there's a chapter in my life where I call her like the blonde Jam, because my hair was blonde at that time, and that was a person that was really very fearless and just really wanted to be me. Like, and no matter what consequences or anything that came with, I never thought about that. I just really wanted to walk around and actually maybe, you know, like today, like I've got a little mascara on, I got a headscarf, I'm looking cute. I have to reflect back on that little blonde Jam, because this was luxury to the life that I'm compared to back then. Like, to be able to walk outside and to be living in my truth like this, like to walk into a space and all of this was really big, you know, to make sure that I'm as Bud's motto was, I'm keeping it real. That's what we were raised to think. And for me, it's like, yes, I can be myself in that inside, but really holding my head up high when I'm leaving the house, that's what it's all about. Yeah.
You were also discovering yourself as a performer. Tell me about the Pioneers and how that group was important for you.
So the Pioneers were everything, absolutely everything to me as a teenager, the best thing that happened to me during those years. And it was because when I didn't feel or see myself in other people or in my town or within my family, and I'm talking about being the queer person, when I auditioned for the Pioneers, I was in shock because everything that I felt like was weird, everything I felt like was unique was literally copy and pasted 20 times. It was me times 20, and I was just
Wait, what were they? What do you mean? What
like,
were they?
It was 20 queer people of color just like me. There was like a Samoan person, queer just like me, with curly hair, sitting there. We all looked like each other. We all had the same mannerisms, same things, like that. Everything that was kind of like alienated because it wasn't a societal norm, together it was just like, oh, it was a party.
The Pioneers were a dance crew, yeah?
Yes, it was a dance crew led by Alain Ronis, and they are still going to this day. And it was a mega crew that competed locally, nationally, and then internationally, which allowed me to work and spend 2 nights a week for many, many years with many queer people of color in the West, just growing up together, working together, and really being creative together in a space. And it took us for me to have less focus in high school because the Pioneers took me to Las Vegas, Nevada when I was in year 10, you know, and I was like, imagine moving from South Auckland, coming over here, not seeing many queer people, but then when you're in high school, you get into a dance crew that is all these people, and then you go to Las Vegas. Like, and we were going for every year as a senior, and then the next year I'd go to San Diego on the border of Mexico. You know, I was living these incredible experiences with people that looked like me, felt like me, sounded like me. I was so lucky. What an incredible life the Blonde Jam had, because that set the tone for everything. Yeah, like that, you can't tell me that is sort of like the template of anything can happen, right?
So it sounds like at this time of your life, you were really flourishing as a person and as a performer. As you mentioned, your mum and dad had split up by this point and you were living with your mum. So Yes. What kind of relationship did you have with your dad, with the Bud, over those teenage years?
It was a tricky one with me and my Bud for a while. It all just simply came down to my father was learning how to raise somebody like me in real time. Had no previous experience with that. But in the times after I came out, I was living away in the new house with mum and my brother, living my life. And these were years, it was about those prominent years I was really thriving in all of that, because I had sole focus to grow on myself. And that came to having distance from my father. So we didn't speak together for a few years. For me, it was just having space away so that I could grow and truly evolve into this being, this vessel that I am. Like, to really honor this, I needed space for that. And he needed space from me as well to understand somebody like me, somebody like their baby Jamaica, is not worth losing, no matter who they are.
How did you manage to change things between the two of you?
My father was a very up the guts kind of person, and his motto was keep it real. The long version was keep it real or go F yourself. And in that, honestly, that was written on the walls at some point of our life. And meaning to say that he's very straight to the point, and you can't beat around the bush. And when it comes to an issue, you go face to face and you talk about it and you just flesh things out. It's not much about the like little back and forth. You kind of nip it in the bud. That's how we were raised. You just get that done. We didn't talk for years, but there was a point in my heart where I could just feel like, even though I grew and I was doing these like amazing experiences in Vegas and all of this, is that I needed him. I really needed him. I still needed my father. So I woke up on my 18th birthday. At this point, I was still living away. And I rocked up. I went over there. I caught the bus over and I jumped the gate. And I walked in and he was in the lounge. I hadn't talked to my father for years. And he was so shocked. He stood up and he goes, "Don't know." And it was just nothing after. And he just held me. And it was just chest on chest. I remember in that embrace, we didn't say anything. It was just, thank you. I could tell he was just so thankful. Thank you for coming here. Because we don't need to say anything, but I'm learning. That's what that hug told me. It's like, I'm learning how to love someone like you, babe. And I don't want to lose you again. And that hug, like, I will always remember that hug. That moment is that he told me, I'm going to try. You know, I don't know much, but you know, he told me, like, you know, we don't know much about this. I said, I know, you know, but he really made a beautiful effort from then on out. He really did. Life just like really excited to heal from all of that. Cause he really appreciated that I did exactly what he would have done. I just went to knock, knock and say, let's go.
Why did you end up living back with your dad, Jamaica?
Me and my mum actually moved back to South Auckland, to Papakura together. I ended up living with her and I had a really beautiful year. I was 18. And then after that, I had this feeling in my being that said, you need to move back home and not in some other house. You need to move back in the home that you left before you stepped into yourself. And that's talking about the family home, like the homestead. I don't know if you call this too, but your family homestead, the homestead. And I could feel that my being knew that something was coming, whether that would be loss, whether that would be grief, whatever it was going to be. I knew that whatever we went through as a teenager is about to not matter. That's just kind of what my spirit told me.
And what was happening with your dad's health after you started living with him then as a 19-year-old?
Yeah, so my father was just a very hearty man that just did. He didn't like to do the checkups. He didn't like to like get up into all of that. What it was that my father was just getting older. He wasn't as 120 miles per hour as he usually is. So getting back to touching base with him and caring for him, yeah, that's really what was needed, because I knew that he just needed somebody to be there for him, and somebody that wasn't just a man around, you know, lack of better words. Like he really needed somebody like me to really have that caring spirit.
And what did that care look like day to day, Jamaica? What were you doing?
First of all, to be there. Me and my brother lived with my father at that time. So first of all, to be there, just to be in the house when, you know, after our days and all of that. He loved to talk. He loved to be there. He loved to catch up. As I said, a truck driver. There was an interstate truck driving story daily. Like, oh my goodness. Like, it was just very funny of just how important these things were. Being there to help groom him as well. You know, he was bald. He had a beard. I was there to really help ensure that he was cared for. I feel like he just needed consistency again. You know, that's what he just wanted. He just wanted somebody to feel strong for him, because my father was always a strong man, always. But when his physical being started not being as strong as what he was used to, if I was strong for him, he still felt as strong as when he was in his prime. And I remember coming over, having just a beautiful healing year, because I connected with the soft side of my father, really touching base. I only can describe him as the strongest man that I ever knew. And he became the softest man that I ever knew at the end. So very weirdly. Yeah, and I'm so, so glad that I followed my heart, my intuition, and my soul telling me that that was the time, because it was the time.
And while he was telling you all these stories about interstate truck driving, were you giving him a crash course in queer life at the same time? Was the teaching going both ways?
Oh, my, well, I think, like, unintentionally, I was teaching him all the time. He would come home from work telling me those stories and go, "Donut, like, I seen someone like you today walking on the street, and I didn't know what to say." And I go, "Well, the lesson is that you don't need to say something, you know?" And he goes, "Oh, really?" You know, I'm like, "Yeah, like, you can actually let these people exist, because they might have five older brothers and a father that just want them to be safe, you know?" It really... anything that was so weird or that was so healed, because Danny, mum, always like told me and made sure that everything that I am is gorgeous and beautiful. And just to be able to make sure that that was received by my father and seen in the end was really very rewarding. I feel like healing would be very different if it wasn't like that.
Your dad passed away just before his 50th birthday. How had he planned to mark that milestone?
My father, I always wanted to go to Jamaica. That's the reason for my name. My mother, when she was just about to have me, said, "What about Jamaica?" And he took it and ran with it. He's like, "Let's go with it." So because Bob Marley was kind of like the handbook of life, really, that was us, that's something that we always yearned to go to, and very far-fetched, like, to go. It's very far from Sydney, and yeah, so we ended up booking a trip with him for his 50th birthday, and my father ended up making it to 48, just before his 49th birthday, and just before then, we booked his 50th birthday, so... we booked that to have just the time of his life. He really just wanted to see everything that was so a kind of a dream. He wanted to live that.
So you and one of your brothers decide that you'd make this trip kind of in his honour, on his behalf. What was it like touching down on Jamaican soil?
Oh, my gosh. Like, I really needed it at that time. I was just like about a year after losing Bud. It felt like the first time I felt genuinely happy again, first of all, after that year. And it felt like I had permission to be shining, like, "You're here, babe." I remember looking over to Caribbean Water, and it was my brother, me, in an empty seat, and I felt his impression. I could feel Bud sitting next to us, and he was so proud. Like, I could hear him saying, thank you for doing this. Like, I always wanted to, and he was living through us, like, so much. Everything I am is Jamaica. Like, the place, the vibes, it all, like...
And were you just wrapped up in some great big Jamaican hug of positivity and good vibes? Like, what was the culture like to be in?
It was incredible, the way that they just harness positivity so much. When the rain is raining, they said, "It's just a bit of liquid sunshine." You know, that shows just how positive things are. The workers would get there hours before their shift and just dance on the beach. Like, they would look at me, and the country motto is "Jamaica, no problem." So it felt like they were screaming to me, "Jamaica, there's no problem," you know? Oh, it was just... the healing and everything that I needed at that time.
So this trip had been, you know, the dream of your dad's. Where would he have wanted to go to honour his love for Bob Marley? What were the pilgrimage sites that you and your brother had to tick off?
The number one was 9 Mile, to go see the village that he grew up in and the town, and to go see the physical spots that, like, "Is This Love," a very famous song with lyrics like, "We share the shelter of my single bed." We saw the shelter that he was talking about and the single bed. These things were like...
What's that village like now, 9 Mile? What's it like to visit?
It's more... it's like upkept through tourist vibes, you know? Like, they've reinforced and... made everything a bit more modernized, but the vibe is there so, so much. Like, my brother is not as spiritual as me, but we sat on a rock that was Bob Marley's meditation rock, and he was like, what is this? And I'm like, I think it's peace. I think it's been a minute since we've felt it, but I think this is peace.
What happened when you visited Bob Marley's grave?
It was a very eerie, white noise room, 6-foot marble case that he's buried with his father. And me and my brother walked slowly around, and we ended up leaving. My brother took off my father's ponamu, a green stone off his neck, and left it with Bob Marley. We weren't allowed, but we just felt very drawn to do so. And
so there's a big sculpture, there's a wooden statue.
Yeah, so you walk in and there's a wooden sculpture. It's from his collarbones up to the top of his head, and it's like Medusa that's all drawn out, this big wooden sculpture. And you walk in and Bob Marley's in a 6-foot marble case. I think it's like a rose-coloured case from memory, but the room is quite small. I would say it's about 5 by 5 meters squared. And in that space is, it just feels like, kind of when you put like a noise cancelling headphones on, it just really felt like muffled and very pins and needles is the vibes that you would feel.
And what did you do as you approached that enormous wooden sculpture?
I just remember walking past it and just feeling like, oh my goodness, like, we made it. That was the epitome of the finish line. Before I left, I gave a hongi, a nose-to-nose greeting to the grave, and I could see Bob Marley and Bud together in my mind. And that for me just like, oh, I felt how happy he was. That Bud was like, I'm all good. Like, I'm going to be fine.
So you left your dad's greenstone there, which must have been a big decision to make, to leave it away from the family and leave it in Jamaica. Did you take anything back with you for Bud's grave?
I think it was a very sudden decision. I remember hearing it rip off my brother's neck to do, but he left that there. We ended up going to the resort on the beach and taking some Caribbean rocks straight off, and then we ended up taking, because one of my other brothers, he concretes, and he was telling me that I can do it, I can put them into the grave. And we ended up putting these small rocks next to my father's headstone, concreted in with him. But actually, it didn't really click to me now until you said that it was a transference of from his grave to Bob Marley's grave.
So tell me a little about the life that you were building for yourself in Western Sydney. How were you introduced to the ballroom scene? You know, what is it and how did you find it?
Yes, so I ended up performing with the Pioneers. You know, we really were doing our worldwide championships and coming home and performing locally, feeling like these local stars. We'll be performing in Liverpool and Parramatta and all of that. And around that time, there's woman ended up coming up to us, and she founded a house of slay, and her name was Benji, and she ended up coming to a Pioneers gig, and I got off the stage and she said, how old are you? I said 15, and she goes, it'll work. And then we ended up starting a house, which is a chosen family, a collective of people that navigate through ballroom as these teams together. And ballroom is a safe space for queer people of color, created by Black trans women of color and Latinx trans women in New York. And it was the only safe space of queer people of color to be, because to put it very bluntly, if these women weren't at the balls, they were getting murdered. So they needed to be themselves. So yes, it is about all of these different categories. We call it the Queer Olympics for everyone. You know, you could do shot put.
What are the categories?
You've got face, you've got runway, you've got different types of Vogue femme, new way, old way. You've got fashion categories. You've got some creative categories called bizarre. You've got body categories. You've got beauty categories.
And where do you shine? What's your number one category?
My category is commentator. So I am the voice of Down Under. I am the voice of Ballroom Australia. And I actually just got acknowledged for that. I just ran my sixth annual ball with my business partner, Xander, and I just got deemed from an international icon from New York, my good sister Asia. She ended up coming over and deeming me a legendary Jamaica Moana. Legendary is a huge status of appreciation. It's almost like getting like the gold medal for your accolades and achievements. So
congratulations.
Thank you very much. So I needs to say is that when I was you know, when I was seen and got into ballroom when I was young, back then, I was one of the youngest people in this space. And now I am one of the most loved leaders in the entire country and oceanic scene, Australia, New Zealand, Samoa. I say that with humility, but I'm really, really grateful to be in a community that's not just about taking, it's about reciprocating energy to harness longevity in lives to come.
How does the Jamaica on stage commentating at a ballroom, at a ball, how does she compare to the Jamaica I'm talking to right now?
Two different people, I would say, is that the Jamaica you're talking to right now is Jam. This is me. That's the name that my family called me growing up. And this is just me day to day, you know, daylight hours is what I say. And Jamaica Moana is my birth name, but it was just a very easy choice to be my artist name. And she is a persona that I created in alignment with the true expression of myself and my identity, truly authentic to who I am. I created a persona that became a shield for me against this world. And I felt like, actually, if I navigate this world as this, like, bad bitch person, this person that's, like, just walking in the room commanding attention in 1 second, that was just something that I felt like, actually, let's hold this and let's make this a career. You know, because the persona that I have, it did not just start as a rapper. Like I have, I started as an actor, dancer, and then a rapper. And all of that, all of those experiences entwine into one.
And so in terms of rapping, your debut album is out. What is it that you love about rapping?
I love that I can say and do what I want. I love that I can continue partaking in a culture that was all about going against the grain and reclaiming. And I'm really, really blessed. I'm a hip hop fan. I'm a rap head. I'm really, really, just as much as I am a mentor for people as I am a student as well. Rapping keeps me sane.
Do you reckon your album would have made it to that line of CDs that your dad had in his cab as he was driving the truck? Would he pass muster? You're not, it's not reggae.
Yes, no, absolutely. I think that he would have put it up there. I reckon he would have put it up on the side to be like, oh, he would have loved. I think my father would have loved that he has a song called Keep It Real named after him. So I don't know if he would be listening to all of it, but I know he would be listening to Keep It Real and My Denny. The song's about Bud and Denny.
How did your mum react to learning that the album was going to be named for her and your dad?
She was so honored, so, so honored. I flew over for her 60th birthday last year and I didn't tell her, but I remember ringing her when I was on the highway in Auckland and I'm like, oh, I'm just on the Sydney highway going to work. And I was sussing her out. I ended up going there and just surprising her. And I said, guess what your present is? It's a song named after you. And it's a song with my brother, her other baby. Her reaction, she was just so honored. My mom's very, very humble. You know, she doesn't realize that all of her lessons of beauty and kindness and everything good about this life is such a template of success for us all, of how we want to navigate life. And she is not a front-facing person. She doesn't like to be out in the cameras or being really heard. She likes to be an enigma with it all. And she likes to be mysterious. So as much as she loves that it's named after her. I don't think she'd want it to be like Burundi Denny 2, and you know, and she doesn't want it to be like going on and on.
How did she react to you walking through the door as a surprise for her 60th birthday?
I remember she was doing the dishes and I walked in and she just looked and she started talking to me. She said a couple of words before realizing that
you were really you there.
Yeah, like it's me. But I remember she just looked over and was just absolutely speechless. Love it.
Jamaica, it's been such a delight to meet you and congratulations on being officially declared legendary and all the best with your music and everything else. Thanks for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you so much.
Jamaica Moana's debut album is Bud and Denny, named after her mum and dad. Today's episode was recorded on Turrbal, Yagara and Gadigal country. It was produced by Alice Moldovan and the executive producer was Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.